this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio and online at kpfa.org. My name is C.S. Song. What do people in the West, and specifically in this country, really know about the Arab world, its culture, its traditions, the many ways in which Arabs live their lives? Stereotypes about Arabs have been developed and deployed over the decades and centuries by thinkers, writers, teachers, and journalists, such that ordinary folks easily come to believe that all things Eastern are inferior to all things Western. Edward Said thought and wrote a great deal about Western perceptions of the East, and particularly of the Middle East and the Arab world. A new volume takes a fresh look at Edward Said's ideas, his seminal writings like the 1978 book Orientalism, and his indefatigable advocacy for the Palestinian cause. One of the contributors to the volume is Laura Nader, a UC Berkeley anthropologist who's done important work in the area of cross-cultural communication and understanding, what the possibilities are, what kinds of mindsets need to be cultivated, and what obstacles must be surmounted to achieve meaningful East-West dialogue. Nader has researched numerous accounts of Arabs who have lived in Western countries and recorded their impressions that just might surprise you. Laura Nader's books include Plunder, When the Rule of Law is Illegal, and Naked Science, Anthropological Inquiry into Boundaries, Power, and Knowledge. When I sat down recently with Professor Nader in our KPFA Berkeley studios, I asked her for some general observations about Edward Said.
Well, Edward Said is hard to summarize in a couple of sentences. He's born in Jerusalem, educated mainly in Egypt, Palestinian background, and then came to the United States and further education here, and started writing and teaching about comparative literature. One of the things that was interesting about him is that he was of Arab origin, but he didn't sound like someone, in quotes, should sound if they were of Arab origin. He didn't have an accent, except a British accent. And he was really smart, not only about the Arab world, but about the Western world. And so he came to hit roadblocks along the way, and it stimulated him to write about the Europeans and how they see the Arab world. And that was his famous book, Orientalism, probably the most important book 20th century written about the Middle East, about how the Middle East is seen through the prism of certain scholars.
How would you define the system or approach called Orientalism that Said famously wrote about and critiqued?
Well, first place, it's mainly European, and we all see the other through a grid. And what was going on in Europe, of course, for the last several hundred years is colonialism and imperialism. So if you are interested in colonizing different parts of the world, you have to portray them. Now, people don't say, okay, if you're a scholar, we want you to portray these people such that they come out to be lesser than we are, but they learn the grid, and they learn to describe Arab men, let's say, as effeminate, and Arab women as downtrodden. And these stereotypes make it possible for colonialism and imperialism to flourish. And I'll give you an example in the area of women that's very striking in the Gulf War. When some of my students said to me that they had heard their parents say, those people don't treat their women well, let's bomb them. And it gives you a chance, if you see the other as lesser, you don't see them as a human being. It gives you a chance to erase them when you can or want to.
Was Said, then, was he arguing that Orientalist scholars intentionally misrepresented the other, intentionally misrepresented people who were not Western?
I don't think he really focused on the intentional part of it, except with regard to a few extreme people like Bernard Lewis. But I think he he was dialoguing with, the first time I met him, it was in a Washington right-wing think tank, actually. He and Sam Huntington and I were on the same panel, and we were talking about can cultures communicate. And of course, Samuel Huntington wrote the book, The Clash of Civilizations. And in that exchange, Said was talking about the clash of ignorance. And he was pointing out that the Arabs know more about the West and the writers in the West and the thinkers, etc., than vice versa, that most intellectuals in the West could not name the major figures unless they were historical. I mean, you can go back to Ibn Khaldun, maybe, but they couldn't mention contemporary major writers, artists, poets, and so forth in the Arab world.
And I'm reading from your article in this book, Edward Said. This is from comments that Said made at this American Enterprise Institute conference, I believe, in 1976. And he said, "People who profess to know the Middle East take an immediate political event, and for an ultimate understanding of it, they take a couple of passages from the Quran or from some 12th century jurist and say, if you really want to understand what is going on, you have to go back to these lines. The equivalent of such folly is to say, if you really want to understand what is taking place in the Congress on the energy bill, you have to read the New Testament very carefully, and then everything will be clear to you." This is very pointed. I mean, he was outspoken on the issue of the ignorance of Americans toward all things Arab.
He kept running into this ignorance. He called it clash of ignorance. It was. And I think it isn't that we shouldn't know about the Quran or the New Testament. It's that it's irrelevant to the moment at hand, perhaps. Sometimes it isn't. So, for example, I'm writing something about the seeds of nonviolence in the Middle East, and I have looked at the Quran because it's quoted today. And so one of the things that's interesting about the Quran in that regard is that the word patience appears over 120 times in the Quran. That's kind of interesting to know, especially since it's quoted today. But to go back and talk about what happened in 650 as if it explains what's happening in Libya today is foolhardy. It's ignorance.
What did Said say, I think, back in 1976 about the way the relationship between the West and the Arab world was perceived by the West?
Well, he said many things. One of the things, of course, people always comment on is the Napoleon's entering Egypt in 1798, the humiliation and the double talk about freedom and equality and so forth. And that interaction was colonialist. And, of course, if you look at the Egyptian historians of the time, and he knew them very well, like Al-Jabarti, he was observing what exactly was happening. Both the French and his compatriots he was observing. But Napoleon came with his own historian. And his historian talked about this as a huge success, that they were bringing civilization to the area. And it had nothing to do with what the historian Al-Jabarti was seeing. Then he goes back to the, Napoleon goes back, and Muhammad Ali comes along and he says, you know, I wonder who these people are anyway. And why don't we send some of our imams and students to Paris to study them, which I thought was a smart thing to do. You'd think we would have done that before we went into Afghanistan. We went in with the greatest ignorance about what probably is one of the most successful decentralized states in the world, and we wanted to centralize it. Well, you'd think we know something about where we were going and what we were going to do. Iraq, Libya, we never learned. So there's this hubris that I think Edward Said was constantly noticing and writing about. Very prolific, beautiful writer, wrote in standard English, and had a large scope for what he was doing. It was world history. He was conscious of world history, the bigger picture, whereas most people are very minuscule. They specialize in decades, not only generations or centuries and so forth, and they don't know anything. I mean, all you have to do is listen to what our president, even with an anthropologist mother, and our Secretary of State, they make the most embarrassing comments about this part of the world. It's embarrassing. It's so ethnocentric. I mean, even with minimal understanding of different cultures, you'd think they would have much more, I won't say erudite, I don't expect that, but at least sort of common understanding of what they're dealing with. Nothing more obvious than mortified the way they dealt with, for example, the killing of Osama bin Laden. I mean, all of a sudden we had a head of state and the State Department saying that targeted killing was justice. An anthropologist used to write about that kind of revenge as, in quotes, primitive. What happened to the rule of law? And so people divided on that. Some people said it is justice. Some people said, what happened to the rule of law? Mm. And of course, if Edward Said were around, he would be the latter. What happened to the rule of law?
Lauren Nader is professor of anthropology at the University of California, Berkeley. We are talking about an article she wrote for the new volume, Edward Said, A Legacy of Emancipation and Representation. Lauren Nader's article is entitled Side by Side, The Other is Not Mute. So if the Orientalist approach is to portray the West as superior and the non-West and its peoples as inferior, was Said's project in any sense about flipping that hierarchy and saying instead that Arabs are inherently superior to Westerners?
No, I think it was the contrary. He was saying that even if you take the most classic of Arab writers who encountered the West, they might say the West, they have no civilization, they have technology. But if they were to learn, they might understand what civilization was. Actually, that's something a Moroccan governor once said to me about the French. They have technology, but they don't have civilization. But they never said it was inherent. It wasn't genetic. It was something that they could learn how to be civilized. And I think we tend to think if someone, in quotes, is not civilized, that it's genetic, especially during this period. So it was much more fluid in the way they looked at others, which isn't to say that there isn't discrimination in all parts of the world, including the Arab world, maybe based on class, maybe based on skills, whatever. But he was talking about a certain kind of discrimination that was in the hands of people who had technological power and the capacity to destroy large populations of people and to leave environmental devastation in their wake. So it was a particular kind of scholarship that was tied to a particular kind of technological and military development that made it important. Now, he never said all Oriental scholars are a bunch of racists, such and such. He never said that. He was very specific in Orientalism, who he was talking about, and of course he was criticized, but very highly reviewed. He didn't talk about the Germans, and he didn't talk about, but he stimulated worldwide thinking on these issues that was hugely, and is still hugely important.
And you've done a lot of thinking and writing and speaking about Arab, for example, perceptions of Western people. And for example, you write about a group of Egyptians who in the early 1800s traveled to Paris. And one member of that delegation, Rifa'a al-Tatawi, actually wrote an ethnographic study of French society that was published in 1834. And that was 3 years after he spent 5 years in Paris. What motivated the writing of al-Tatawi's book?
One of the things he was sent to do is to learn how to translate. So he was basically a student of translation, and he had to write a thesis. And I think this started partly as part of his studies there, because at the end of his book, he also included the criticisms of his professors, which was also something most of us don't do. Most anthropologists don't spend 5 years in the field. Most anthropologists now don't even learn the language, let alone the problems of translation from the Booga Booga, whatever they use, to English if they come back and publish here. So it's a rather extraordinary model of how to do an ethnography that's very modern today, very modern, because now we're talking about subjectivity, objectivity. And here was this man, he was doing it. And it was about the time that de Tocqueville came to the United States. I think the books came out 1 year difference. One came out a year before the other. So Al-Tahtawi was sent there because Muhammad Ali had a modernizing project in mind. So he studied all parts of this culture for 5 years. The way women dressed, where people slept. I remember when he first got to Marseille, he thought it was funny, that amusing, that people in France slept on stilts. That's what he thought, because he'd never seen beds before of our sort. But he looked at everything, and he observed, and he commented. Now, how did he observe, and how did he comment? This is what's interesting. And this is what I think Edward Said was part of this tradition. He would say things like, you know, the French, they have cleaner bathrooms than we do. But our bathrooms are healthier because they're steam baths. And steam baths are healthier than tub baths. But yes, their bathrooms are cleaner than ours. You see, he would look in the mirror. Whereas at the same time, Edward Lane, who was a Britisher, was writing a book about Cairo. And he wrote a very nice piece that's sometimes been analyzed about the mirrors in the cafes. And he studied these cafes, but he never saw himself in the mirror. And that's what's interesting about the people that I mentioned here. They see themselves in the mirror. And if you look at our leaders now, our cultural leaders as well, they can talk about other parts of the world, but they don't see themselves in the mirror. So they can talk about the need for democracy or whatever in Booga Booga, Afghanistan, Iraq, etc. And they see no discrepancy between that and rule of law and targeted assassinations. So it's very important, I think, that we adopt a style which allows us to learn about ourselves when we study other people. Now, I studied at Harvard with Clyde Kluckhohn. My mentor was a very distinguished anthropologist who died young, unfortunately. But he wrote a prize-winning book called Mirror for Man. And he thought of anthropology as being a mirror for man, for us. And I picked that up because it was, to me, it was obvious, especially for people who are bicultural and bilingual and so forth. Of course. So, mirror for man, what's happened to that concept? Well, we got specialized. You go to the Navajo, you study the Navajo. You go to Korea, you study the Koreans. And as I was mentioning earlier, even if you do comparisons with what we have here, let's say you go to India and you study Indian women and the difficult lives that they lead, and you come back and you say, oh, those poor Indian women. But you don't say, what about the poor American women? Mm. There are people now going all over the world, aid people, teaching men in different parts of the world, from Bolivia to the Middle East, that they shouldn't beat their wives. Well, the statistics are pretty high on American men beating their wives here. So why isn't that ever in the same book or in the same observation? Amnesty International did a study of wife beating in Syria. 26% of Syrian husbands beat their wives. They didn't include in that any comparison. I went downstairs to the librarian and I said, look up what the figures are here. Same percentage, 26% in the United States. Now, most people who point the finger and say those people don't treat their women very well are not looking in the mirror, and some of them are women.
Well, it's always, it seems, easier to talk about the other and criticize the other rather than looking at one's own faults or shortcomings.
But it's a strategy. I don't think it's just a happenstance. It's a strategy that is linked to control and domination. And so I think that anybody who pushes against that is to be rewarded.
Is it also linked to a kind of emotional commitment we have to thinking that we are superior, that we are the most advanced and enlightened people?
The whole notion of progress enters in here. Progress and technological, equal to technological progress, and the hubris of being so powerful. And then we think that, in fact, everything else is also. Now, Thomas Jefferson redefined the notion of progress. In his mind, it was social progress we were aiming for, not technological, not to put aside technology, but does technology make our lives better? And social progress is an important issue here. But yes, there's something else going on here. There's the humanitarian impulse, it's been called, where Americans want to help other people. They're very innocent. They have no conception that that help may be in the service of power. And we were bombing Iraq, and there were humanitarian groups going to Iraq trying to liberate Iraqi women. And we were killing the women. So it's crazy contradictions that operate here, and it comes from being in a society that doesn't look in the mirror, that is in constant denial, or that beats itself into cynicism and depression or whatever. But the leadership, we don't have the leadership now, even in universities. Universities got so corporatized that it's hard to find that kind of leadership there. But we don't have the leadership that really will tell us what we need to know to really be the powerful, enlightened leader in a world that's now global.
This is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio, online at kpfa.org. My name is C.S. Song, and our guest in studio is Laura Nader. She is an anthropology professor at the University of California, Berkeley. Her books include Naked Science, Anthropological Inquiry into Boundaries, Power, and Knowledge, The Energy Reader, and Plunder, When the Rule of Law is Illegal, which she co-authored with Uto Mate. And we have a link on our website to a new book called Edward Said, A Legacy of Emancipation and Representation, to which Professor Nader contributed an article. The book is edited by Adel Iskandar and Hakim Rustam, published by University of California Press. And we also have a link to Laura Nader's homepage at Cal. Let me return to some things you've written about Eastern folks, in the broad sense of that term, visiting Western countries and writing about them. And I find them very enlightening and sometimes counterintuitive. You write about two Turkish sisters who lived in Europe for 6 years from 1906 to 1912. One of them wrote letters to a British friend, and you've looked at those letters. What kinds of observations of European life did those letters relate?
Well, it was interesting because the reason they wanted to go to Europe was to see how life was like for women who were liberated. So they must have been told by their nannies or whatever that Western women have better lives than Eastern women. So they went with open mind to see this. As soon as they got to Venice, they threw off their veils. And that was the first feeling of liberation that they had. And then slowly they began to travel, 6 years, of course, to Britain and France and so forth. And they began to notice that the women there were not as liberated as they thought they might have been, that they were just as patriarchically treated by their men. In fact, they drew analogies between English men and Turkish men. And they found that it was a patriarchy, but a different kind of patriarchy. And at the end, Grace Ellison, the Britisher that they were writing to, said to them, because they decided to go back home after 6 years because it wasn't what they thought it would be, and that women had a better life in Turkey than they had in France or England. And so they went home, at least they would have solidarity, because in sex-segregated societies, of course, at least the women are together. They're not individuated and separated. So they were disappointed, is to say the least. They were bitter, almost, as if they'd been fooled. And it was interesting at the end when Grace Ellison says to them, we're not ready for you to become like us because we're not free yet.
This is the British friend?
This is the British friend. And these are British women, by the way, who went to Turkey and the Arab world because they thought it was freer there in the harems and so on. They were working on women's liberation in England, let's say. And they would go to see, to make their argument in the opposite direction of what we make it now. And so they both sort of concluded that these are two patriarchal societies and they dominate women in different ways, but they're dominated. And so the Turkish sisters said, I'd rather be dominated in Turkey than in England.
Mm. And you've pointed also to the travelogues of some Western women who visited or lived in the Middle East in the 19th century, in the 1800s, and the impressions they had of Muslim women. And I guess in at least one of those travelogues, they said the women in this Arab nation are far more independent and have more rights than we do back in the West.
Right. That's hard for Westerners to swallow. I remember when I was in the third grade, I came home and I said to my mother, mind you, I was being taught this in the third grade, why do Arab men not treat their Arab women well? And she was furious, and she looked at me and said, when you grow up, you will learn that this society disrespects women more than any society. And there was a lot of truth in that. And I'm not just talking about discrimination at the top levels and so on. I'm talking about, I don't know if you saw the film, The Social Network, but that was a film about Harvard undergraduates and how they treat women. And the men there in that film were all entrepreneurs, and the women were basically all sluts, in my day we would call them. And that was the portrayal of Harvard University undergraduate life. And I think that's the sort of thing she might have been talking about. When I went to Morocco, the interesting thing was there were a higher percentage of women faculty at the University of Rabat when I went than there was at Berkeley. And there was, by law, equal pay. And there was maternity leave. When I went to talk to the equivalent of HEW in the Sudan, they wanted to know what American women's lives were. So I said, well, let me tell you about mine. 1960, I was the first woman hired in the anthropology department at Berkeley. I've never had equal pay. I never had maternity leave. They could not believe it, because they had it based on their belief that they were copying American, what was already available to American women.
Laura Nader joins us on Against the Grain in our KPFA Berkeley studios. She's written many books, including Law in Culture and Society and The Life of the Law, Anthropological Projects. She's also written an article that's part of a new volume, Edward Said, A Legacy of Emancipation and Representation. And in 2008, she gave a talk called What the Rest Think of the West, Legal Dimensions. And then in a little while, I'll ask Laura Nader about that talk. But we turn now to one of the editors of the volume in which the article I've been discussing with Laura appears. The volume is Edward Said, A Legacy of Emancipation and Representation. And the two editors are Adil Iskender and Hakim Rustam. Adil Iskender is an adjunct professor at the Center for Contemporary Arab Studies at Georgetown University. He joins me now by phone from Washington, D.C. Welcome, Adil.
Thank you for having me, Sia.
Thanks for joining us. So what motivated the preparation of this particular volume?
I think what motivated the volume was sort of a recognition of the dearth in the literature as far as Edward Said's contribution to various fields of knowledge. He had grown increasingly sort of vilified and criticized, but had also become a fairly controversial and polarizing figure, both within the academy and outside of it. And so our point of contribution was the attempt to encapsulate his legacy in a manner that makes it comprehensible to future generations of scholars, academics, and activists. So given the fact that he was an incredibly prolific thinker and intellectual, it was a very colossal task on everyone's parts to try and sort of bring all the strands together. He had contributed so significantly to so many different fields of knowledge that it was very difficult to bring together activists, anthropologists, sociologists, philosophers, international lawyers, and people from different sort of areas of inquiry together to sort of describe what Edward Said had done and where to take his project next. So this was the impetus for it, and the decision to move ahead with the project happened shortly after his death in 2003, and the book, of course, was published last year. So it took a fair amount of time for it to come to fruition, but it was a sort of a necessary period of incubation that allowed the authors to sort of develop various theses about Edward Said. So the book sort of, you know, is very expansive in more ways than one.
Oh, there are lots of contributions to this volume, too many to mention given the limited time we have. But could you give us a sense of what else besides Laura Nader's piece is included?
Well, Laura Nader's piece is a really fantastic contribution to the volume, and one of many in some ways. But the book is divided into different sections. You know, one particular section is focused on the colony and colonization, and also the post-colony, the idea of post-colonial theory, and what that's contributed, and where the shortcomings of post-colonialism happen to be. And then another section is focused on the Israeli-Palestinian sort of impasse, and something that was incredibly important and informed Edward Said's work from its early days in the 1970s all the way through until his passing. And then the final section is about the role of the intellectual, how intellectuals find themselves within sort of within societies. How are they treated? How do they become engaged? What forces and what challenges do they have to face to become engaged in contemporary society, whether it's in the West or elsewhere? So, so the book, you know, tries to look at Edward Said's contribution in those three areas, while at the same time being focused on what we believe are the two primary themes, the two sort of running themes in most of his work, which are emancipation and representation.
And the book is Edward Said, A Legacy of Emancipation and Representation. We're talking to one of its co-editors, Adil Iskander. Has Said's work and his critiques and approaches, have they become in any sense mainstream? In other words, have any of his ideas broken through to really lead the way in thinking about certain topics?
This is an incredibly political question, largely because it depends on who you ask. I happen to believe that Edward Said has been quite influential within the academy and outside of it. He's really shifted, at the very least, some important disciplines that are at the juncture of the interaction between sort of East and West. By deconstructing the ideas of what is East and what is West, he's really impacted, you know, such disciplines as Middle Eastern studies. One would be hard-pressed to find a course in Middle Eastern studies today at any university in North America that doesn't assign, one of Edward Said's writings, even though he was trained as a literary critic. So in some ways, I think that his contribution is quite significant. We're starting to feel sort of the repercussions of his writings and his work all the way until, you know, the contemporary day. He's been gone for quite some time, but nevertheless, even when looking at the Arab Spring, the Arab revolutions, the uprisings, Edward Said's, you know, work is quite informative. Even when discussing the Palestinian Israeli situation and the sort of the stagnation of the peace process, or what is, you know, what many people believe is cynically described as the peace process, some of his writings from 1994-95 on the Oslo Accord are very, very informative. So he remains incredibly relevant all the way through, and has left a major mark, and is dearly missed by many of his colleagues, his comrades, his students, and those who find sort of solace in his work.
Yeah, as you said, he died in 2003, and I think he was born in 1953, was a professor of English and comparative literature at Columbia for, I think, four decades. We're going to have to leave it there. I want you back sometime to talk about other things you're doing. Adil Iskander is adjunct professor and media scholar at the Center for Contemporary Arab Studies at Georgetown University. We have a link on againstthegrain.org to his and Hakim Rustam's book, Edward Said, A Legacy of Emancipation and Representation. That's on againstthegrain.org. You can find a link there. Thanks so much, Adil, for joining us today.
Thank you for having me, C.S. Appreciate it.
And we return now to my conversation with Laura Nader, UC Berkeley anthropologist, taped recently in studio for broadcast today. Well, you know, you were talking earlier about law and the rule of law, and there's a lot of rhetoric around legal systems and what undergirds, for example, the Anglo-American system of law. A guy named Mirza Abu Talib Khan, and I'm sorry if I'm mispronouncing that, he visited London around the year 1800, and he had some very specific observations about British practices and British liberties. What did he observe?
He was quite a character, this man. He saw the British coming into India. He got curious about the British. He made friends with a Scottish man who said, well, why don't you come with me? I'm going back to England. So he got on a boat and went back with him. And of course, he was so bizarre looking because he was dressed in a different way, etc. He immediately hit all the social circles and the cocktail parties and so forth. But one of the things he did in his observations was to get himself into a legal fight over a tailor who wouldn't give him his money back for work that wasn't well done or something like that. He found himself in court. And he made observations in the court about the injustice that was present. At the same time, he complimented the judge because he said, at least he doesn't take bribes like in my country. So he made these observations. And he, of course, was in the social circles and he talked to people. And again, the question of women came up. Mind you, this goes way back, this notion that somehow Eastern women. So a woman comes up to him at the cocktail party and she says, we think you Eastern men don't treat your women well. And he says, that's interesting. We think Englishmen don't treat you well. How could that be? She says. He said, well, in the first place, our women have their own spaces. Mind you, we're talking about elites. And they can decide when they want a man to come, their husband to come and visit, and when they don't. If they're too busy with their children, they don't put their shoes out or whatever the signal was. And he said, in your country, you have to sleep in the same room. Well, you're in the same bed, he says. Maybe that's because it's cold in England. But then he continues his observations about law. And it involves self-criticism, as well as the criticism of the British and what they were doing in India. That is unusual in today's writings, that you do both, because you're supposed to be objective and detached, like Lane was in Cairo. Then none of these people were detached. They were observing, and that was the skill. Observing, talking to us about what was going on in their minds, and the stimulation that the other gave them to look in the mirror.
Did he, in saying the British courts, at least the British judges, were reluctant to be bribed or immune from bribery, was he saying that British courts were free of corruption?
He didn't say that. He mentioned the judge. He also said the lawyers were extending the case so that they could keep getting paid. And there ought to be public interest lawyers, was what he was saying way ahead of his time. So these are creative thinkers, and they're elites. And I think what happens to some of them that went abroad is the same thing that they were trying to do with Edward Said that they couldn't do, which is to reduce him to some lesser person, right? So when Al-Tahtawi went to Paris, at one point somebody referred to him as a dirty Arab, and he had all kinds of negative things said to him. And he would sort of laugh and say, they don't know where their ideas came from, because he knew that the scientific tradition of Islam had then been reworked into Europe. So he was impressed with what the Europeans had done with what they had inherited, but he knew they had inherited it. So that it was eye to eye, just as Edward Said was eye to eye with Sam Huntington. He wasn't thinking he's a professor at Harvard and I'm just a poor, you know, whatever. That's what bothered the Americans, many Americans with him. And with anybody from other parts of the world that come here and talk eye to eye.
Al-Tahtawi, again, was the Egyptian who went to Paris in the early 1800s.
Now, one of the things I think that's important to remember is that we're talking here about people in the past, but there are people today who do this kind of writing, and we hardly ever hear about it. And one of the most interesting figures, which I quote in the Hastings article, is a man named Isa Shivji. And he is a Tanzanian legal scholar. And in 2003, he was supposed to go to a conference, I think, in England or Scotland. And he was so shocked and upset by the U.S. entering Iraq and bombing and so forth, he didn't go. Instead, he wrote this piece about the West and the law, in which he said, we have to rethink the Enlightenment period. We have to be able to separate words from deeds. we have to understand that the new enlightenment of neoliberalism is destroying people's lives worldwide. A very impassioned, very interesting article, which ends on a tone that Edward Said also shares, which is, we need to take the best from all of the civilizations in the world to build a planetary culture. Now, that's not cynical, it's not bitter, it's a wise person trying to lead the way as best he can, and would that we had at least one or two people like that in every American university.
Yeah, his name is spelled ISSASHIVJI, law professor at the University of Dar es Salaam in Tanzania. Was he attacking in this talk, was he attacking Enlightenment values, or was his attack on the hypocrisy of the West in talking about certain values and acting in another way?
I think it was hypocrisy, which is now so apparent to most people in the world. Most people understand democracy, want it, as we've seen in the Middle East this spring. They will put their lives on the line for it, but it's not our practice they want to copy. It's our ideology or our belief system in a egalitarian form of representative government.
Laura Nader is our guest on Against the Grain. I'm CS. She is professor of anthropology at the University of California, Berkeley. I don't think I'm going into different terrain in asking you about the essay you wrote in 1994, urging, I think, what you called a comparative consciousness in the field of anthropology and probably beyond it. What did you mean by comparative consciousness?
I think that I want people, scholars and others, to recognize that it is a human component, that no matter what we see, we are implicitly comparing it to something we know. So I want the implicit comparison to become explicit, so that when we say they have no rule of law, we have some idea that we have a rule of law. But in fact, if they make that explicit, then you can make the argument that it's not always put in place. So I want people to be more thoughtful about what they see around them and what they see elsewhere in the world. And it doesn't necessarily have to be cross-cultural. You could have comparative consciousness right here in the United States. You can compare the attitudes of the people in Vermont on single payer or Medicare for all with the attitude of the pharmaceutical companies on that, or the insurance companies. It's a way of thinking that makes for critical thought. We need critical thought. This morning I was reading Science magazine. They're always talking about education, how we must improve education, science and math and so forth. And they're always talking in terms of recipes. I don't teach empty vessels. People that come before me all have a history. I take that into consideration when I teach them something so that they can use their experience to understand the world that they're living in. And it works a lot better than standardized tests or multiple choice tests because it teaches them how to think about their world. And we need people who think in all kinds of jobs. We need people who, in quotes, connect the dots, because there are such astonishing things that challenge us. And let me tell you, we have this Japanese disaster, Fukushima, and you would think that we, along with some other countries, would say maybe we ought to rethink our nuclear policy. Instead, the President of the United States and everybody who's a pro-nuclear, whatever, stands up and says, we're going nuclear because we know how to handle it now. They've always been saying that, we know how to handle it. I mean, Indian Point is 26 miles north of New York City. And if there's an accident, they're going to evacuate New York City in 24 hours. So something is going on in the way people think about problems that shows no benefit of experience.
The Energy Reader is one of Laura Nader's newer books. She's also written books like Law in Culture and Society and Naked Science, Anthropological Inquiry into Boundaries, Power, and Knowledge. It would seem, Laura, that thinking comparatively and truthfully would involve a kind of piercing the veil of what you might call propaganda, that so much of what we think of ourselves is influenced by what we hear through the media and other information outlets, and that colors our perception of our own culture and traditions. And of course, then there's a whole set of propaganda that surround what we hear about other people, what they do, their practices, their customs, the way they treat women or anybody else. So is developing a comparative consciousness at least partly about seeing through the filters and the veils that are placed on us by the kinds of information that we get?
Well, there's no doubt that that's a very important consequence of learning how to think critically. World War II was interesting because we had researchers looking into propaganda. The word propaganda was used. Interesting that you use it because it's rarely heard here. But the propaganda we were interested in piercing was Nazi propaganda. When people started applying it to their own culture here, they cut off those courses. It was too threatening to the churches, to the military establishment, and to all those who have their own controlling processes that they didn't want people to disbelieve in. So, look at NPR, National Public Broadcasting. What do they select? The Republicans think they select things on the left. The left thinks they select things on the right. In fact, the most time that's spent telling you who's sponsoring them tells you who's selecting. Because the people who sponsor them, whatever companies or points of view or schools or whatever, are going to determine part of what goes into NPR. So unless you have something that's free from government and business interference, you're going to get propaganda. And over, the repetition is amazing. If you listen 24 hours to NPR or the, I don't have a TV set, but if you listen to any of this, propaganda, advertising. In my course on controlling processes, I always had a question on the final exam that was something like, could you imagine a world without advertising? You should see the answers I get. What would we look at? Was one common answer. What would we look at? Well, you might look at the trees, right? Instead of the bulletin boards. Or it's not possible to have a society without advertising. Well, clearly they don't know that socialist countries didn't have, Soviet Union didn't, Cuba and so forth, didn't have. We have such a warped view of this is inevitable. We are inevitable. We can't do anything about it. That's the way it is, and that's always the way it is. And who are you to say that it's going to be any different? So I think we're deeply propagandized.
How important to the development of a comparative consciousness is the seeking out of commonalities among people?
Well, that's a very good question, because when you talk about comparisons, it sounds like you're always looking for difference. And Edward Said always looked for commonalities. That's why he talked about world history and what we shared and so forth. It's imperative that we look at what we have in common if we're going to survive on this planet. And it's come to people's attention through climate change issues, although I've got some questions with how that's also propagandized. It's clear that there is climate change, and it's worldwide, and it's going to affect us all. And maybe that will create something about common bonds that we all, survival is something we all have to strive for. Otherwise, there's no Homo sapiens. So I think it's very important to talk about commonalities.
Are you worried at all that a focus on, okay, we see some practice in another culture and we say, well, that looks bad, but wait, in our own culture, people do the same things to the same people, same kinds of people. Are you worried that that might bleed into a kind of moral relativism where we begin to say, well, no, we really can't make judgments about other cultures. That would be a kind of imperialism of its own, and therefore we should let people kind of do what their traditions and cultures dictate and have for so many years?
That could happen, has happened. What I think is important is to pick issues that probably everybody could agree on. And health and safety is certainly our issues. That has to do with survival again. You know, nobody worldwide is mad at Ralph Nader for seatbelts and airbags. And nobody would get up and say in public he shouldn't have fought for clean air and clean water and things like that. Those are very basic. And nobody's going to say that it's okay if some people don't have water to drink as long as the companies operate the way they want to operate. So we have to get back to real basics. I don't think anybody in Syria or in the United States would say that, yeah, let's let them beat their wives. Why? Because health and safety and survival. The problems enter in when we go to Samoa, let's say, and we say, oh, they have free sex and teenage life, and so why don't we introduce the same thing in the United States? Why are we so uptight and puritanical? Well, that happened, actually. And now you have problems of sex without love and all of the problems of attachment and deattachment, et cetera. It wasn't a panacea to open that door. So, I mean, we've got anthropologists have something to answer for, too, in this relativism question.
Laura Nader's books include Plunder, When the Rule of Law is Illegal, which she co-authored, The Energy Reader, and Naked Science. And again, she's written an article for the new volume, Edward Said, A Legacy of Emancipation and Representation. Laura Nader is professor of anthropology at the University of California, Berkeley. Thanks so much for joining us and for joining me in studio.
Thank you for having me.
And this is CS, suggesting the important thing is not to stop questioning. And we will look for you next time. Against the Grain is co-produced by Sasha Lilly and C.S. Song. Please check us out on the web at againstthegrain.org, where you can find on-demand and downloadable audio. And it's free. And you can also call us at 510-848-6767, extension 670. And maybe, perhaps, check us out on Facebook at Against the Grain Radio. Many thanks to Erica Bridgman, who's at the controls today.